we are interested in any potential port services that can be provided for the lower part of the river, basically the vicinity of Bethel.
Developers of the Donlin Creek Gold Mine look for partners. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 12th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a deep water drilling moratorium is lifted, but it doesn't impact Alaska.
Secretary Salazar has made it clear in his statements that he intends to halt production in Alaska, and we continue to work and push back against that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Developers of the Donlin Creek Gold Mine are now seeking a new set of partners to support their project. With exploration complete, Donlin is now looking to secure a transportation route for their supplies. Their current plan calls for a new port facility in the lower Kuskokwim, but they'll need to secure some land agreement first. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel reports.
The proposed mine site is found near the Kuskokwim River, about 200 windy river miles above Bethel. But somewhere near Bethel, Donlin is going to need some space. That's where they plan to unload supplies off their large ocean-going barges and onto smaller barges, barges that can navigate the shallow Kuskokwim. So they're contacting some of the bigger players operating in the region.
The letter went out to Bethel Native Corporation, City of Bethel, Crowley, Linden, the Village Corporation for Napakiak. It also went out to Chelista.
Mary Sattler handles public relations for the project.
This isn't just landowners. This is entities that could provide services.
What Donlin says it needs at a minimum is a 16-acre port with room to service an ocean barge and a river barge at the same time. The port will also need room for storage and building facilities. The formal document they're sending out is called a Request for Expressions of Interest.
Basically, it's just letting people know that we are interested in any potential port services that can be provided for the lower part of the river, basically the vicinity of Bethel.
Who that partner is will have a big impact on who benefits financially in the lower Kuskokwim area. The city of Bethel has by far the largest port in the region, but not large enough to accommodate Donlin traffic along with its current traffic. Sattler says developers will be looking to anyone that wants to become a partner.
We haven't entered into any negotiations with anyone. There's nothing official happening yet. We just want to find out what land is available and who might be interested in partnering with us in the future.
Donlin wrapped up decades worth of exploration at the site, but the timeline for development has been pushed back several years as they look for a cheaper energy source. This summer, they explored a route for a possible gas line coming from Cook Inlet. Sattler says the current plan is to begin the permitting process at the end of 2011. Donlin estimates that will take at least 3 to 4 years.
At that stage, we'll be looking much more seriously at getting a port so that we can look at construction.
Donlin is a joint venture between Barrick Gold and Novagold, as well as the Chelista Corporation and the Kuskokwim Corporation. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Obama administration announced today that deepwater offshore drilling can resume in the Gulf of Mexico, but the decision doesn't affect Alaska, where shallow water drilling is on hold. Reaction to the news that the White House is lifting the deepwater moratorium was mixed, with environmentalists calling the move premature in the wake of this year's Gulf of Mexico BP blowout, which was the largest oil spill in U.S. history. On the other side, drilling advocates say the decision lacks teeth because of uncertainty in how soon production can go forward. Alaska's two senators both say they want to see Arctic Ocean projects advance. They were temporarily delayed in the wake of the Gulf spill. Democratic Senator Mark Begich called Salazar's announcement positive for the oil and gas industry, but said he's frustrated that Alaska was left out of today's decision. Senator Lisa Murkowski, the top Republican on the Energy Committee, said the equivalent of a de facto moratorium still exists in Alaska. Her spokesman Robert Dillon says they believe the shallow type of drilling sought in Alaska should not be on hold.
It doesn't do anything to further Alaska's goal of developing its offshore resources. Alaska is technically not under any moratorium, but Secretary Salazar has made it clear in his statements that he intends to halt production in Alaska, and we continue to work and push back against that.
Secretary Salazar said today that his department must be aggressive in raising the bar for the oil and gas industry's safety and environmental practices. His press secretary, Kendra Barkoff, had this to say.
Secretary Salazar believes we need to continue to take a cautious approach in the Arctic that is guided by science and the voices of the North Slope communities.
Salazar visited Alaska last month for a town hall meeting in Barrow and to tour the North Slope oil fields. He has said he would have to let Shell Oil Company, which wants to drill in the Beaufort Sea, know by early next year if it can move forward, because the company would need to get ready for the summer season. Critics of drilling in the Arctic say not enough research exists about cleaning up oil in icy waters and fear harming Alaska Native communities' subsistence harvests like whales. Proponents say it could bring in money and oil and gas that could help America be less dependent on foreign oil. The ice in the Arctic Ocean has long forbidden shipping and oil exploration, but no longer. A record withdrawal of sea ice in 2007 has been followed by similar retreats ever since. The oil industry and shippers have suddenly become far more interested in the new frontiers opening up as the sea ice pulls back. Yesterday, reporter Johanna Urich brought us a look at impending oil and gas exploration efforts in the Arctic Ocean. Today, she brings us the second part of the series on shipping in the Arctic.
In 1971, Peter Wadhams went on the first British submarine to venture into the Arctic to survey ice thickness using sonar. And he's been on every British sub since, checking ice thickness and distribution.
The methods we were using to collect it were more primitive. We weren't getting these nice 3D images. But you can still use that data to get the distribution of thickness of the ice back in the early 70s and compare it with what we're getting now. And that's what's showing this very big decrease in average ice thickness, at least 40% decrease in average thickness.
Wadhams has been studying the shape of multi-year sea ice in the Arctic. This is ice that has survived many winters. It's cut up by cracks that routinely appear in the ice pack. Multi-year ice, once the dominant ice in the Arctic, has become an endangered species. Wadhams expects it to disappear in 20 years. The only sea ice left, he says, will be that which forms in the winter and melts in the summer, or one-year ice. Sea ice is not forming or melting uniformly through the Arctic. The hot spot for melting is off the coast of Alaska and northwest Canada. But there are forces at work beyond the warming of the Arctic Ocean that can cause multi-year ice to disappear quickly. It's happening not too far from the place with the largest and most stable collection of old multi-year ice, off Ellesmere Island near Greenland, a place called the Alamo by ice scientists, named that because it's expected to be the last stand of old sea ice in the Arctic. In 2007, just around the corner from the Alamo, an ice bridge that normally stopped up a thin strait between Ellesmere Island and Greenland melted, letting loose a veritable stampede of multi-year ice heading south and trapping Canadian fishermen used to fairly open waters off Newfoundland. David Jackson is acting director of the Canadian Ice Survey, which watches ice carefully to help its Coast Guard respond to dangerous conditions. He says many fishermen and sealers were caught unawares.
And what happened in 2007 was that multi-year ended up down off of the coast of Newfoundland and formed a real problem for some of the fishermen that were going out, the sealers that were going out, and about 100 of them got trapped and had to be rescued by the Coast Guard.
The Canadian Ice Service does not expect the Northwest Passage to open reliably for shipping in the next decade. Jackson says before that happens, it is much more likely that the relatively thin ice in the center of the Arctic Ocean near the North Pole will open. That may prompt changes in shipping routes, saving a huge amount of time and money. The country that is most aggressively pushing the frontiers of Arctic shipping is Russia, which has most of the coastline bordering the Arctic Ocean. It's also the nation with the Arctic's largest estimated offshore oil and gas resources and with the largest fleet of icebreaking ships. Russia is developing a fleet of nuclear icebreakers and tankers. Robert Tustin with the international firm Lloyd's Registry of London says commercial nuclear ships are inevitable. The move towards nuclear propulsion is being driven by the world's move to cut greenhouse gases. There are no carbon emissions from a nuclear reactor.
It's the only known source of power for ships that is greenhouse gas emission free. There's a perceptible change relative to that. The nature and the characteristics of the discussions between the builders and the owners about new ships, there's a perceptible change. They'll seriously consider what might have been unthinkable a couple of years ago.
Russia is not the only country interested in developing commercial nuclear shipping. Korea and China are also actively looking at it, but the Russians are much further along. Next summer, Russia is planning to sail a nuclear-powered supertanker, escorted by Russian nuclear-powered icebreakers along most of its Arctic coastline or the Northeast Passage. This nuclear push gives some marine architects and engineers the willies. Russia's not known for its high safety standards. The safety of any venture in the Arctic is questionable as ships and oil rigs move further and further offshore. This spring, the Arctic nations are expected to sign a search and rescue agreement, but it'll be mostly words. There are no international standards for Arctic ships or oil rigs. Except for Russia, most Arctic nations have few icebreakers and even less rescue capability, either on board the boats or on shore. I'm Johanna Urich.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, keeping workers on the job in Huna.
Because there's not a lot of storage in these things, but it's a great hunting cabin or a guest cabin or whatever, you know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Social Security turns 75 years old this year, and the venerable program is under attack by some already in Congress and by others hoping for election to that body. Senator Mark Begich and Senate candidate Scott McAdams are both on record as supporting the program, but as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer tells us, Senate candidate Joe Miller has another viewpoint.
Public support for the current Social Security program remains strong, according to a report commissioned by ARP. That could be one reason to be concerned that Alaska's Republican candidate for the United States Senate, Joe Miller, is on record as saying Social Security should be privatized. Miller, in comments aired on national television, spoke with ABC's Jonathan Carl in July.
It's a system that is broken. And so
Miller echoes the policy of former President George Bush, who had suggested privatization for Social Security in 2005.
Well, I think it's absolutely critical that the government keep its contract with the seniors that are currently dependent on Social Security. Now, part of our concern in this campaign is that the financial insolvency of this country is going to create an all-stop with respect to honoring federal obligations. And those that are most dependent are going to be the most hurt when we hit that sovereign debt crisis. So the first, I think, bit of order that we've got to get in place is financial solvency. But yeah, ultimately, we've got to transition out of the Social Security arrangement and go into more of a privatization.
As of this year, 71,000 Alaskans receive Social Security checks. Some of them are children, some are disabled, others are widows. In August, Face the Nation's Bob Schiffer asked Miller about his views.
First you say you want to phase out Medicare, you want to privatize Social Security. I have to say, there are a lot of people in Alaska who are on Medicare and are getting Social Security. Isn't that position going to be a problem for you in the election?
We just simply want to get back to basics, restore essentially the constitutional foundation of the country. And what that means is there does have to be some transition. With respect to Social Security, what we've said consistently throughout this race is that if you're dependent on the system, we have got to get the fiscal house in order at the national level so that we can continue to pay those benefits. But to suggest that there is nothing that can be done, that we have to continue as the way things are, ignores the fact that the trust fund is empty, it's full of IOUs. It ignores the fact that as of April of this year, there are more expenditures or there are more outlays coming out from Social Security than inlays. And it would be incredibly irresponsible for us to sit back and say that this is something that shouldn't be addressed.
Miller says there are a lot of different options for a Social Security fix, including privatization. He warns a solution is needed or seniors may be left out in the cold. But some Alaskans say if it ain't broke, why fix it? Democratic Senate candidate Scott McAdams signed a pledge last week to fight cuts to Social Security benefits and to stand up to attempts to weaken the system. McAdams said at a candidates' forum Monday,
I do not believe that you balance the federal budget on the backs of kids, seniors, working people, or a young and developing state. You know, Social Security, when you take a look at the solvency of the plan, status quo has it relatively healthy through the middle of this century. You lift that cap.
McAdams wants to raise the cap on the system's payroll tax. Write-in candidate and incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski wants to raise the benefits age.
We've got to recognize that it's not in the earmarks, it's not in the discretionary spending that we're really going to see reductions in our deficit. It comes when we take on the big stuff, the entitlement programs. One way that I think we've got to critically look at is the Social Security program. We know that we've got more that are receiving from the program that are paying in. Or is it possible that we need to look to increasing the year within which an individual goes on Social Security?
Miller countered that getting the federal government out of state affairs would cut deficit spending.
So when the federal dollars do end, and they will eventually end at some rate, they aren't going to continue at the rate they are today, folks. They can't. We know that. I mean, our budget right now, if you look at it today, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and servicing to debt, that's equal to the revenues coming into this country at the federal level.
Average Social Security benefits to Alaskans are between $13,000 and $14,000 a year. Those checks keep about 22,000 Alaskans a year out of poverty. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
At yesterday's Anchorage Chamber Senate debate, the U.S. candidates also tackled the issue of health care reform. Asked if they would support, vote to repeal or modify the new federal health law, the Republican candidates were eager to denounce it. Joe Miller said it can't be tolerated.
It's got to be repealed. The likelihood over the next 2 years that happens is low. We have an unfriendly presidential administration that probably will veto such an effort. There may be some low-hanging fruit in the bill that could be repealed, and I think we ought to work hard in that direction. But if the repeal falls, then obviously it has to be defunded, and we've got to make sure that the federal government cannot take that power grab and continue to expand its power in a way that's going to hurt our economy.
Lisa Murkowski stressed that she not only voted to oppose the health care plan, but she voted to repeal it. She also said it's probably unlikely that it will be possible to repeal it under the current administration. But she said that if it is repealed, change still needs to come.
We must, as a Congress and as a nation, reform health care. We did not do it with this bill. We have not increased access nor decreased your costs, and you're going to be seeing this in these upcoming years. We owe it to the American people to figure out how we rein in the costs. And how can we do it? We can start with some things that have been put in place in several other states like Texas and California.
Murkowski said medical malpractice liability reform and the ability to be able to purchase insurance across state lines are examples. Democrat Scott McAdams said that the bill's process was in itself an example of how broken the Washington system is.
You know, with 150 Republican amendments, this bill could as well be called Mitch McConnell Care as it's called Obamacare. But I'll tell you, Mr. Miller believes in repeal. Senator Murkowski believes in repeal. I believe we should take what is good about this bill, maintain it, and improve on some of the challenges that are laid out.
McAdams said the unfunded mandate of mandatory coverage troubles him, and he said he'd want to take a look at that as part of an effort to improve the law. The candidates were also asked how they would address the congressional attacks on the Alaska Native Corporation's involvement in the Small Business Administration's 8A program. Republican Joe Miller says the 8A program needs reform.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of benefit flow back to the shareholders. I would suggest that in reforming the 8A program, that we need to focus on shareholder employment. Get hardcore numbers out of the contracts that result in actual benefit
to our rural communities and the shareholders of those corporations, rather than focused on these monies that ultimately flow in large part to subsidiary corporations where there's not real benefit to the natives themselves.
Senator Murkowski said she has supported and seen the benefits of the 8A program for Alaska Natives. She said the benefits are so strong that others outside of it want to know why they can't get in on the same type of contracting.
The reason that this was made expanded for our Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, and American Indians was to allow for those that have been socioeconomically disadvantaged. We do need to make sure that we get good value for our contracting dollars. That's imperative. We do need to look to make sure that it is being administered in a manner that is clear and transparent.
Murkowski says she'll fight Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill's attempts to limit ANC involvement in 8A. Democrat Scott McAdams says he also supports the ANC 8A contracting ability and criticized McCaskill's lack of vision. He said the billions in wealth that distributes through Alaska is important, but there are future aspects to consider.
My goal throughout the course of my lifetime is to see the day when forever gone is Alaska the colony, where people from the outside come in, extract our resources, take the best bite of our apple, and move their resources and their money offshore. The great thing about both the 8A program and the business acumen that's been built up through it in our Alaska Native corporations is that we have got a great resource ready to serve Alaska for the rest of the century.
Other questions touched on war funding, fighting terrorism, and reining back deficit spending. The entire debate can be found at our website, aprn.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The prosecutors in the case of the late Senator Ted Stevens have had a contempt finding against them lifted. U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan blasted three government attorneys back in February of 2009 for missing a deadline to turn over documents to Stevens' lawyers. He held them in contempt, but one of the attorneys filed a motion to vacate his decision. The judge denied that today, but he did dismiss the issue. That's because the prosecutors did eventually turn over the information to Stevens' lawyers. The civil contempt finding that was on the books for the past year is separate from a criminal investigation going on into the conduct of the Stevens case prosecutors. Stevens was convicted 2 years ago of failing to disclose gifts on Senate financial forms, but 6 months later the judge threw out his conviction because prosecutors hadn't turned over important information to Stevens' lawyers that could have helped them in their defense. Judge Sullivan ordered a criminal investigation into what went wrong, the results of which are pending. Ted Stevens died in a plane crash in Southwest Alaska in August. A massive fire in July that destroyed its mill building and main breakdown saws hasn't slowed production at Icy Straits Lumber and Milling in Hoonah. Owners Wes and Sue Tyler have used back inventory to do small projects, keeping Icy Strait employees at work. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, they remain optimistic that new milling equipment will be running by the end of the year.
Wes Tyler got his green Chevy Suburban at a U.S. Forest Service surplus sale. It's a fitting rig for Tyler, who gets most of Icy Straits Lumber and Milling's timber from the Forest Service. As he steers the truck up Hoonah's Eagle Drive, surrounded by Tongass National Forest, Tyler says his goal has always been to make something useful out of the naturally abundant trees of southeast Alaska.
You know, take the timber base that we have here and make locally usable goods out of it.
Tyler pulls up to a small two-story cabin.
This here place here, I'll show you this real quick. Okay. Some of our products put to use right off.
Measuring 14 by 20 feet, the cabin features an open floor plan. The cozy living room leads to a kitchen with just enough space for a refrigerator, sink, and stove. Off to one side is a tiny bathroom with a shower. A ship's ladder in the living room heads up to a half loft with a pair of twin beds.
This is a good, probably a two-people cabin. And I mean, if they're not, you know, entrenched with a whole lot of stuff, because there's not a lot of storage in these things, but it's a great hunting cabin or a guest cabin or whatever, you know.
The cabin is just one example of Icy Straits production since the fire destroyed its mill building. The mill housed the breakdown saws that cut large logs into boards. After the fire, Tyler says they still had plenty of inventory, some smaller saws, and the dry kiln. He thought, why not do some projects to keep the company's 12 employees busy? So far, they've been able to do that, and he says they've got a couple months' worth of material left.
We've got a lot of paneling material or siding material out there yet. And we've got probably four or five loads to go through the kiln. And the dry products are what you use for your interior, you know, your paneling and stuff like that.
Icy Straits headquarters is the home Tyler shares with his wife Sue and their dog Lacey. Overlooking downtown Hoonah, the Tylers have lived here 7 years. It's the kind of home you'd expect lumber mill owners to have. Sue Tyler says it represents every type of wood used in their products.
There's a little bit of everything. There's a little bit of yellow cedar, a little bit of red cedar, a little bit of hemlock, a little bit of spruce.
Not only that, but it represents Wes Tyler's belief that every part of the tree should be put to use. He points to a wooden fish hanging on the wall.
These are scrap pieces that one of our local guys carves into these fish and things like that. These are just decorations made out of some wood that was not usable for lumber, but good for that kind of thing.
Tyler sits in his kitchen nook looking out across the bay at where the old mill building stood, a view he wakes up to every morning. He says he's probably lucky he wasn't in town the morning the mill went up in flames.
Had I seen that out there, I might have got there just in time for that thing to go bam.
The state fire marshal's office determined the fire was caused by hot metal or a cigarette butt that ignited sawdust, causing an aerosol can to explode, which in turn triggered additional explosions. Tyler figures it'll cost about $100,000 to get the mill up and running at full speed. He's been looking for new equipment to replace what was lost in the fire and hopes to order new saws within a month. But he says it'll be another year before he replaces the mill building. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Chevron says it will sell its assets in Alaska's Cook Inlet. The Peninsula Clarion reports Chevron announced today it will sell Cook Inlet assets owned by Union Oil Company of California and Chevron USA Incorporated. The company has interest in 10 offshore platforms. Chevron also will sell its interest in the Cook Inlet Pipeline Company and the Kenai Kachemak Pipeline, LLC. The company says producing properties will be offered as a single package. Chevron reports a workforce of about 450 employees and contractors in Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Johanna Urich and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.